Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCOrtho.
Well, hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. She is certainly at the very top of our list of people that we love to have here. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can just, you know, write us at voxpop@wamc.org and give us your comment that way. Look, folks, there will be a lot of calls today. If you want a general psychiatry question, or if you want a question about drugs, or if you want a question about addiction, sexual addiction, anything like that, give us a call. Welcome, Jen. Anything specific on your mind this week?
No, nothing specific. I mean, people are dealing with this epidemic of opioid addiction. And some people are still talking about the sad loss of Robin Williams and suicide and people at risk. So, there's always something in the news that's related to mental health.
Okay, let's take a call. Let's go to Kerry in Plainfield, Mass. All right, Kerry, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey.
Well, my question today about is 12 years ago, my father, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And after a few months, it became worse where he was hospitalized. He was in the hospital for a couple of weeks, and I got a call one morning that he had took a turn for the worse. So my mom and myself went down, and they had him in a private room. And he was unresponsive, and for about five or six hours we were there, and he was still living. And this nurse kept coming into the room and checking on him. And in a comforting way, she would say to my father, well, it won't be much longer, and you'll be joining your deceased parents. And that always kind of bothered me. And, I even questioned her about that. And she said that was her way of comforting the patient. And is that, considered acceptable common practice in a situation like that?
Did she really use the word deceased?
Well, my father was 77. His parents were deceased. So I don't know. I don't think she maybe used the word deceased, but you'll be joining your parents.
Okay, Dr. Michaels.
So it's not that uncommon to talk to people who are unconscious and try to comfort them or connect with them, whether with words or touching. I'm interested in the fact that you said you were so uncomfortable with it, that it made you feel ill at ease.
It really did. I mean, like I said, he was unresponsive, but I don't know if his brain was working where he could take that all in, what she was saying. But, like I said, he couldn't connect with us in any way.
Yeah. So you're right. We don't know if someone's brain is working, if they can take it in. But we also, wonder, is it harmful or is it really helpful and loving to speak?
I guess that's my question.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's harmful. And I think it can be helpful. It can be very loving if the person can hear you speak. But it also may help you if you had decided to do something like that. It can help the loved one feel some peace that they're doing their part to help their loved one pass away in a comfortable way. It's not harmful. I think it can only be helpful.
Okay. Well, like I said, it was something that I had thought about, and I had to ask you.
Sure. We're uncertain about it, but I think it can be a very loving way to say goodbye to someone. So
okay.
Please know, no harm was done.
Okay, thank you, Kerry.
Yep. Bye.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Get online. We'd love to talk to you. Let's go to Jane in the Pioneer Valley. Okay, Jane, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because a friend of mine has epileptic seizures and takes medications for them and also drinks heavily. And I wondered if there was a negative interaction between alcohol and the medication she takes.
I think your instincts are right, Jane. Alcohol can ultimately lower the seizure threshold, so it can make you more likely to have seizures. If your friend has a seizure disorder and then she drinks, you know, it's dicey. It could make her have a seizure after the alcohol leaves the system. So, you know, she shouldn't be drinking, or she should be drinking a minimal amount of alcohol.
Have you ever told her that, Jane?
Well, I didn't have the information, and I was just trying to get some background before having a discussion. It's hard to talk to someone about these issues, especially if, you know, I mean, especially if you don't know what you're talking about. But it just, but the interaction of the drug and the alcohol specifically is not dangerous. Is that correct?
It could be potentially. I mean, if a seizure, anti-seizure medication causes sedation, and then alcohol causes sedation, it could be, you know, synergistic and cause the person to pass out or become unconscious. It's not what you would hope. Let's put it this way. I would hope my patients would not be drinking if they're taking an anti-seizure medication. I'm going to make a suggestion when you talk to her, though, and I think it would be great for you to talk to her. Do what I call a compliment sandwich. A compliment sandwich is say something kind or complimentary, like something to your friend, like, I think you're wonderful, I care so much about you. Then you zing her with, I'm really worried about your drinking. And then you say the other side, the compliment is, and I know that you can do something about this because you're so smart or you're so wonderful. So please say something to her and think about that, the compliment sandwich.
Well, the question I have for you, Dr. Michaels, is whether or not it's possible that Jane's friend is also addicted to alcohol.
Well, that you bring up an excellent issue, because if you drink chronically, the alcohol can cause seizures. And then sometimes people who are alcoholic end up on anti-seizure medications, and then they keep drinking.
And what would you say chronic drinking would be? How would you define that?
Well, if there's a year or more of excessive drinking that leads to functional impairment, and, you know, what does that mean? That means maybe she's had a DWI, or maybe she's missed work because of her drinking, or she has multiple hangovers. It affects relationships. Some of those, events are enough to qualify for a drinking problem.
Okay, Jane, we're going to let you go. Thank you very much.
Okay,
and it's 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a very short break, and that'll give us more time in the middle, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Midwives of the Hudson Valley and Capital Region, offering women's health care, maternity care, and home birth services throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital Regions. Midwives support WAMC.com. The Springfield Symphony Orchestra presenting Kings, Angels, and Lovers with violinist Caroline Golding, October 25th at 7:30, springfieldsymphony.org. The Urgent Care Centers of Middletown Medical, providing walk-in medical care with no appointment, daytime, evening, and weekend hours in Middletown, Ellenville, and now in Chester, middletownmedical.com. And Allardyce Glass and Mirror, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing sales, service, and installation of glass shower enclosures, mirror, and screen products for the home, allardyce.com.
And we are back with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, one of our favorites. Dr. Michaels is here to talk to you about mental health. She's a psychiatrist with all kinds of boards, and you know her, and we love having her. Okay, let's go to Ellen in Albany. Ellen, you're on.
Hello.
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Ellen.
Ellen? Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Well, Ellen seems to have disappeared. We're sorry about that. Let's go to Carol in Conway, Mass, 1-800-348-2551. Carol, you're on.
Hi. Hi.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, Dr. Michaels. Thank you for taking my call today. I'm the mother of a 31-year-old guy who's a really terrific guy, and he's doing well. He's been living in a group home in another state for about 4 years and doing great there. But he has a, prior to that, very long history of hospitalizations, homelessness, very rough life. And he's getting ready to move out of this group home. And I'm worried, naturally, because he has done, you know, he has taken off in the past, and this is not one of those situations. He's doing everything the way he ought to do it. But when he does move out, he won't be in a structured program. He doesn't have employment. So I'm afraid things are going to start slipping. And yet I want to support him in this decision because he's 31. You know, it's his life. What would you suggest as a good approach to take with him in terms of being supportive, you know, encouraging with this sort of a transition?
So Carol, it sounds like he's done very well in a group home. So has he decided this on his own that he wants to move out? No one is pressuring him to leave.
Not a bit. They've been wonderful. And I'm very grateful to them, you know, for the program he's been in. It's not perfect, as you can imagine. Most of them are very low funded. Mm-hmm. But he's stayed on his meds and so forth. And the thing is, this program encourages people to become independent, to move on, you know, get a job, get their own place, that sort of thing. And he just hasn't done that. And he feels, you know, he wants to just be on his own. He doesn't want to be part of this program anymore where it's structured. He has to go with the guys in a van, you know, 4 days a week. They go into town, and they don't give them anything really to do. They just sort of hang out.
So my hope would be that he would transition in a more thoughtful way. And I agree with you, the looking for work or volunteering or having a program, I think it would make sense for him to have that to hold on to and then transition to his own place. Usually is there a team that's helping him?
Oh, there is. And, you know, I speak with the manager of his home somewhat regularly, and we have pretty, you know, wonderful long talks, and, you know, she's very supportive toward me. She tells me what a great mom I am, which is beautiful. You know, people who love someone with a mental illness really relate to that. You know, it's tough.
It is
tough.
And you do sound wonderful, by the way.
Thank you. Well, I'm very proud of him, and we've managed to stay close through all the years of, you know, his turmoil. You know, it's devastating, this illness, what it does.
It's a challenge. It makes me think of a few things. You know, you're probably already involved in NAMI, which is a support group that will help you. And for anyone listening, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill is a great group for someone just like Carol, who has a loved one with mental illness. Also, there is community-based flexible supports, otherwise known as CBFS, and they provide a hybrid of services. So people can move out of a group home, but into a house with almost like an adoptive family that are trained to help the loved one, to help this person, and to do some kind of work during the day. I mean, there is work available. There's outreach so that he can receive his medications where he lives. So I would recommend you talk to the CBFS team. Community-based flexible support team that should be helping your son with this transition. And I always say a slow transition is better than a fast transition.
That sounds good. And that way I have a little something to kind of hold on to because I'm a little, you know, worried about him, and I want to see him succeed.
Yes.
Hey, Carol, I'm going to let you go, Carol. Everybody else is trying to get a chance.
Much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
Bye, Carol. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Ellen in Albany. Okay, Ellen, go.
Hi there. Yes, I have a question. It basically starts with Concerta, which I had taken starting around 07, which helped me come out of a clinical depression where no other SSRIs or anything else helped. So apparently dopamine was part of the problem. However, after the last 3-4 years, I've noticed sort of a progressive clinical kind of fatigue. And the Concerta stopped, you know, acting as a stimulant. Matter of fact, nothing else I've taken has worked either, any kind of other type of stimulant. So anyhow, now that I have like an adrenal fatigue situation, I'm trying to balance, I think concern is more part of the problem in a way than was the solution. And in addition, I developed this obstructive sleep apnea, which seems to be also releasing cortisol during the night. So it's a number of different symptoms which somehow may be related to adrenal fatigue at this point, but I think Concerta is a major part of the problem.
Okay, Ellen, only because there's so many people behind you, let me ask you this. What's your question for Dr. Michaels?
How, if that's the case, how to withdraw or go off, gradually go off the Concerta, which is, you know, added this dopamine effect and afraid of going into another depression or just withdrawing from it altogether. So that's a little tricky right now, especially dealing with the adrenal fatigue, which is, I think, considered a masking sort of the fatigue and causing the problem as well.
Okay, that's the question. Okay. Now let's get an answer.
So, Ellen, I hope you have a really good primary care doctor who's helping you with this.
Oh.
No.
That's the problem. I just came back and I do not.
Okay, find one. Find a really good primary care doctor because you have a lot of issues that have overlapped symptoms. You know, you could have fatigue from your adrenals, from sleep apnea, from Concerta, depression. And so you need a manager. And I find more and more today that patients are their own medical managers and it never works out well. So get a primary care and then that person will help you to navigate the breathing, the Concerta, the adrenal fatigue in an organized way. And I would suggest that person help you figure out the Concerta.
Ellen, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Barbara in Poughkeepsie. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. In fact, after Barbara, 100%. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hello, thank you. I'm calling because my niece is going to be graduating from college with a degree in psychology in May. She's interested in pursuing a clinical psychologist PhD, but she's been told it's very, very difficult to get into grad school without some real life experience. So my question is, if she is unsuccessful at being accepted, what kind of jobs would she be able to pursue with a four-year degree in psychology that might better her chances if she reapplied?
Well, I'm not an expert in that part of the education system, but I've worked with people like your niece who have done direct care work, who have done research, and have also volunteered. So I think that any of those would be good options for her to add to her CV and, and bolster her application.
How does one get a position for research or direct care?
Where is she in school? Because the school should be able to help with...
Yeah, well, she's at a small liberal arts school, so there's not a lot of, you know, like, opportunities necessarily for, you know, she's not associated with a research institution.
Is there an area that she's specifically interested in? She could look
anxiety and depression with adults.
So she could do a Google search and find out who's doing research in that area. Is there a location, a school that she's interested in pursuing? And then she can contact the psychology department and pursue it that way.
Okay, great. So thank you very much.
I wish you the best.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, Robin in Saratoga. Okay, Robin, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
I'm calling to disagree with the doctor about her opinion on what the nurse was saying to the man who was dying with cancer. I think it was inappropriate of her to bring up, to say to him, you know, everything's fine, you'll be with your deceased parents. It's presumptuous of her, firstly, to think that he believes in an afterlife. And secondly, he may have had a lousy relationship with his parents. I've been around for the death of both of my parents, and my response and what I expected from everybody else there, and what was, we love you, and what you are ready to do when you are ready to do it, you know, we honor that.
Okay.
And,
okay. All right. Okay? No, Robin, stay there. Go ahead, doctor.
Well, I appreciate the feedback. I think in general that makes sense what you're saying, that you should be able to say what you want to your dying parent. I think what I was saying was I don't think any harm happened. Mm-hmm. You know, that I don't think I was trying to comfort the person who called. That I don't think anything harmful happened.
And but also this. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Sure.
But there's something called context. We don't know what was going on in there. The nurse may have been talking to the affected patient.
Yeah.
So it may be that she picked up on something she had heard earlier from him. We just don't know that.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But it's a good point. I think that family, you know, it's a good discussion to have before you're in that situation, how to deal with it and to do it in a way that honors the person who's going through that.
Mm.
So thank you for your feedback.
Yeah, I've seen it with my parents. I don't like how my mother was spoken to in hospice, and I have a chronic illness, and I've been in the hospital, and I've had a few responses from health professionals that I thought was just nasty and trying to push me over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Robin.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Noelle in Plattsburgh. Okay, Noelle, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling. I read a study recently regarding women who take SSRIs in pregnancy for depression. And there being a possible correlation between that and rates of autism in their children. I've heard that previous to this, the SSRIs were safe. There's some very rare birth, you know, defects that can occur. So I was just wondering, what is the current state of that? Is it safe to take them?
Thank you for that question, Noelle. I know of no study that has shown that there's a relationship between SSRIs and autism. There's obviously something coming out every day, but as far as I know, the current research does not support that. And that is a great discussion to have with your obstetrician, because a lot of times people feel they have to stop their medication when they get pregnant. But stopping a medication when you get pregnant can also, you know, potentially cause complications if you get very depressed or you don't eat because you have a depression. So I would follow what you and your obstetrician decide together. Right now, there isn't enough research to support any connection between SSRIs and autism.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. There's one call coming up, and then the phones are free, and we offer you an opportunity to get on with Dr. Jennifer Michaels. It's a terrific opportunity, by the way. 1-800-348-2551. Carrie, okay, in West Haven, Vermont. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi, Alan.
Yeah.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
I was just wondering, you don't hear it on television or radio or read it in the papers, people clinically depressed, drug resistant, electroconvulsive therapy. Is there a reason why that's not talked about?
That's a good question. Some people don't know this, but ECT or electroconvulsive therapy is still being used, and for just those situations you brought up, medication-resistant depression or severe depression, if someone's suicidal and depressed, that it may be used for that reason. I think there's a lot of stigma involved still. And so people do not talk about getting ECT. It's not widely advertised. It's actually one of the safest treatments for people who need emergent treatment for depression. So it still is around, and it's very effective.
You know, I had the treatments in 2011 in October, and they were terrific.
That's great to hear. It helped your depression.
I went in and out of depression since, I believe it was 81. Mm. And in 2011, once they came up with the right anesthesia, it just worked great. And I know prior to going, I had talked to some people that had the treatment, mm-hmm. and they scared me. They told me about losing 6 months, 8 months of their memory and things like that, and I was scared to death. But
it worked well for you.
I had a little short-term memory loss, but I've regained that, and I feel great.
I really thank you for sharing your story, yeah. because no one treatment works for all people. So, you know, sometimes people think, Prozac, everyone should get Prozac for depression. Well, everyone is different, and some people need ECT, and that's what works.
Yeah, I still take medication,
mm-hmm.
But it's worth it.
Good to hear. I'm so glad you're better.
Carrie, thanks for the great call. Appreciate
okay.
it. Yeah,
thank
bye.
You.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. We go to Joyce in Millbrook. Okay, Joyce, you're on.
Thank you. I just, you know, during the onset of menopause, a lot of women experience anxiety and depression. And my understanding is you have estrogen receptors throughout your body, and that might be a reason why this happens. I'm just looking for the doctor's opinion and feedback on any other reason why this happens at that particular point in your life. What physically happens that causes those things to happen?
Okay. Well, Joyce, I'm not a gynecologist, so I'm not an expert in that area. But I do know that yes, when people go through menopause, they are more likely to have insomnia, anxiety, sometimes depression, irritability. And it's thought to be due, in part at least, due to changes, fluctuations in hormones. What's interesting is antidepressants can alleviate some of those symptoms. We're very focused on estrogens, but for example, paroxetine or Paxil just got approval for hot flashes, and it's not uncommon for women to take an antidepressant or a benzodiazepine during that transition of menopause.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551, and we go to Jason in Pittsfield. Hiya, Jason.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Dr. Michaels.
Hi.
I don't have a question. More of I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on using methadone for heroin and opiate addiction as a, you know, a way to combat that. You know, I mean, just what your
sure.
thoughts on using methadone were.
Sure.
Opposed to Suboxone or quitting cold turkey.
Well, I think whatever works to help the person and keep them alive is the right thing to do. You know, and we have a variety of treatments. We have 12-step programs like Narcotics Anonymous that works for some people. Other people need Suboxone. Others need methadone. We also have an injection called Vivitrol, which lasts for a month and blocks opiate receptors. And you can do a variety. You can mix and match. But the main thing is to get help. Currently, less than 10% of the people who need help for opiate addiction are getting help. And we think that's because of stigma.
Sure.
Yeah, opiate addiction or addiction in general is the number one stigmatizing disease in the world. And that keeps people from getting help. It's the barrier. So methadone is good. You know, for if someone needs it, Suboxone, any treatment is good rather than no treatment.
Sure. Yep. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Jason, thank you.
Yep. All right. Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. So stay right there. If your name is Carol or Peter or Mike, we'll be right with you.
Support comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. Union College Concert Series, presenting Polish pianist Rafał Blehasz, performing works of Bach, Beethoven, and Chopin, Sunday, October 26th, 3 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org. New York Oncology Hematology, offering clinical research trials towards FDA approval of anti-cancer drugs. When experience matters most, newyorkoncology.com for a list of clinical trials. And Curtis Lumber, proudly serving their communities for over 100 years, providing lumber, building materials, doors, windows, paint, and more. 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont, curtislumber.com.
We're back with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, and are we happy to have her here, as always. Let's go to Carol in East Hampton. Carol, you're there.
Hi, hi. Welcome. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a nephew who's 21 years old and has had an opiate addiction since he's probably been 14 or 15. We weren't aware of it until he was probably 16 or so. For the last 2 years, he has been using a Suboxone patch. And the way it goes, he goes to the doctor for $150. You see the doctor, he gives us a prescription. He's having no counseling. Mm-hmm. He's still self-medicating with both alcohol and marijuana. And we just can't seem to motivate him to do anything, you know, further than that. And I thought the Suboxone was something that got weaned off of at some point. So... Mm-hmm. What to do, and sure. Do you get weaned off of the Suboxone?
So I'm concerned because your nephew isn't getting the full treatment.
You know, he is not.
It's like if you had a diabetic patient, you gave them insulin and you said, go home and take care of your diabetes, you know, without
that's
any.
That's exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really concerned about that because he should have therapy. He should have some recovery, meeting people and creating a sober network. He's missing out on that. And as far as the Suboxone goes, the measure of success of his treatment is not whether or not he's on Suboxone. It's how he lives, his functionality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does he have friends? Is he working?
He sits in his room all day.
Yeah. So he needs a more comprehensive treatment. And I don't know if you have that available in your area, but that would be a day program, evening program, urine toxes. And I'm sad to hear he's seeing a doctor who is probably making a lot of money, but not helping your nephew very much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can't seem to convince his parents, my brother and his wife, that this is not sufficient. This is doing nothing, you know.
It's what we call harm reduction. Harm reduction is if he's taking Suboxone, he's not going to be, you know, taking.
Yeah, he's overdosed twice, so they're afraid.
Okay, it's not working.
Yeah. No.
And what I suggest is let's make a plan B, which would be more treatment. And, they need to look into what's available in the area. People can also be sectioned. They can be sent away against their will if it's life-threatening.
Yep.
That's called a Section 35 in Massachusetts.
Yeah, he's down in Florida now. Okay. Well, I tried talking to both of them, and they just seemed... At least he's safe and in the house, and he's not going anywhere. He's not doing anything. And don't worry about him having another overdose, but definitely not. It's sad. It's sad.
It's very sad.
Carol, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
I'm sure you've helped somebody. Yep.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's go to Peter in Cairo. Okay, Peter in Cairo, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. My son, about 10 years ago, was suffering from severe depression, and he had 11 ECT treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one, when they first gave him the shock, he failed to convulse. So they immediately gave him a second shot, which affected him very adversely. He still has memory loss to this day, 10 years later. And I was just wondering, could ECTs actually cause brain damage?
Well, as the previous caller noted, you can have memory impairment for a period around the ECT, but it shouldn't be permanent. It shouldn't impair your ability to learn new information. But you may have impairment for months at a time around the ECT treatment. So
yeah, with him, it's continuing even to this day. People who knew him from the past, you know, when he was growing up, he'll pass them on the street and they'll say hello, and he's embarrassed because he doesn't remember who they are. Or he can watch a movie and then 3 months later watch it all over again and laugh, you know, without, as if he had never seen it before.
So I'm wondering if he would benefit from testing to see what is his brain doing? What's his cognition like? You know, he could go to a neuropsychologist and you could get a better picture of how he's functioning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't know if clinical studies have already shown if ECTs could cause damage.
It can cause memory impairment around the time of the ECT, and so before and after, the person may not remember. So if you told me one of those people on the streets, he knew a month before the ECT treatment, it wouldn't be surprising if he didn't remember that person. The other thing to remember is depression is very damaging to our brains. When we're suffering from a bad depression, we can't remember, we can't make new memories very well. And so, you know, if he suffered with a depression for a period of time, it may be a challenge to use his memory in the best way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Mike in Amherst. Mike, you're on.
Hi. So I'm a senior in college. Got a million things on my mind, but I'm also working as a direct care professional prepared for grad school. I have a client, age 73, with clinical depression, and as is typical of that population, he's suffering a lot of cognitive deterioration. And I am responsible in my position to really engage him in the community and in various activities, and it's just so difficult. And I was wondering if you had any tips for dealing with this specific population.
Is he getting treated with medication for his depression?
Just medication. He sees a psychiatrist or for therapy once a month. But for as far as his day-to-day engagement, that's what I'm responsible for.
Okay. Well, you may want to look up cognitive behavioral therapy because it helps to look at the distortions, the thinking errors that go along with depression. That may help him, and it may give you some tools in engaging him. A lot of people working with the geriatric population, I'm sure you realize this, but there's something called pseudo-dementia of depression. When people are older and they get very depressed, they almost look demented, and it's a symptom of the depression. As the depression gets better, their pseudo-dementia will get better too.
Oh, so there is a chance of cognitive improvement.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's hard to tease out, but what we see in general is that people who have depression and pseudo dementia they'll kind of accentuate or put a spotlight on their dementia. Someone who truly is demented will minimize those symptoms.
Mm,
so,
right.
So there's hope.
So you're recommending I look into some of the aspects of clinical or CBT,
cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing.
Mike, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Robin in Ballston Lake. Robin.
Hi. Well, I was just going to ask you what you think of dialectical behavioral therapy or cognitive therapy for depression. I have had depression since I was a child. I'm 57 now, mm-hmm. and I'm on my meds. But this summer, I went to a wonderful program at Four Winds, which is our local place here. It was outpatient, and you go like 5 days a week and have these intensive classes, and they teach you dialectical behavioral therapy. The hard thing is that when you leave there to find a clinician who will help you continue studying it and trying to behave in a way that helps you. So do you believe in that?
I think it's great. Do you want to tell people what DBT is?
Yeah.
Let's spread the word what DBT is. Tell people what you did.
I don't know if I'm prepared to do that, but we had... there are different categories under DBT, and they are your emotional state, your ability to communicate with others. Maybe you can help me.
Mindfulness? Did you do some
mindfulness? Mindfulness is the huge thing, so that when you're going through the day and you have a conversation or you actually do something like stay in bed all day, you're very mindful of what you're doing, and then you can take steps, actual physical steps, to do something that's the opposite of that, so that you can get yourself out of bed, or so that you can communicate more effectively with your husband or your friend or something like that. So if you get adept at DBT, I heard that if you practice it like crazy for 2 years, you almost can sometimes get off of meds.
Well,
I don't know if that's true.
Well, the focus should be to live a great life, whether you're on meds or not. But dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy are two wonderful tools to help you to get going. Rather than focusing on why am I depressed, let's look back, let's examine this. The idea is let's look forward, let's use these tools to engage my life. And they're great.
Yes, yes. Robert. And if you can really study it and practice it, I can tell you that it works. It's, you know, that depression is always pulling you back to try to keep you from doing that. But if you really try to have a strong will and keep practicing it, it has helped me a lot.
Thank you, Robin. I'm sure that's going to help a lot of other people to know this.
Okay, thanks.
Call 4 Winds. They will recommend a therapist for DBT.
I think Nancy is gone. My fault. Let us go to Steve in Great Barrington. Hi, neighbor. How you doing?
Hi, good. How are you today?
Okay. What you got?
Well, this may sound simple or even, you know, like old school or something, but do the foods we eat and the minerals, the vitamins, the enzymes we get out of food, has there been research to show that by changing our diet, we can avoid a lot of problems if we stay on a healthy diet? And if there is research that proves that, you know, wouldn't doctors or shouldn't they go that method before getting into taking pills and other chemicals and introducing them to solve certain problems?
Well, you know, there are real diseases, real mental illnesses that are chemical imbalances or have to do with genetics and environment. So I don't want to minimize that by saying if someone changes their diet, they won't get depressed or won't have panic disorder. But certainly having a balanced diet, and I always think of a rainbow of colors. You know, you want to eat foods that that are in nature and not from a chemistry lab. That's the way to go. But these diseases are real. You know, people suffer, and rather than having shame about medication, about ECT, we need to be grateful that that treatment exists.
No, I'm not shunning the ability for people to get help in any way, shape, and form. If it works and they're better, that's great. But it just seems like I had a niece, she took eating too many bananas, and she got sick from that, diabetic. And I had another one who was eating too many carrots, and they said that wasn't too good, and they had to change their diet. But they had real side effects from just good foods. So I'm thinking, in my mind, I would say that if you were getting chemicals and minerals and things out of foods, perhaps there should be some research, you know, to help use foods for, you know, a better purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm quite sure it's probably been done somewhere around. Did you Google it, Steve?
Yeah, I've been Googling it, and what I always end up seeming to go to is I find that people are using vitamins as a, you know, quick cure. Mm-hmm. I got depression, my heart's depleting a certain vitamin, so I want to take that. But I'm not so sure that, you know, the pills are the way to go as much as taking things in through food.
Sometimes it's not either or, you know. Sometimes it's both. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Nancy in Altamont. Nancy, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me? I have it on speakerphone.
Perfect, but speakerphone is never great, but what can I tell you?
Okay, no, I'll take it off. It's okay. We have a daughter who's 26, and ever since she's been in high school, she's had depression and anxiety. She now lives in Buffalo. She's a teacher there, high anxiety job, and she's on Prestique. Mm-hmm. And she's been on Prestique for quite a while, and she's seeing a psychiatrist there who she goes to every 2 to 3 months, who basically just gives her a prescription renewal. There's no counseling. And she has to pay out of pocket For the Prestique because of the high deductible plan she's on, and I don't believe there's a generic equivalent for Prestique. Is there anything else that she could be on or any other suggestions? It doesn't seem she's getting counseling and are concerned. She's like, sees this psychiatrist for maybe 10 minutes and gets charged about $200, and she pays out of pocket.
Well, you know, Prestique is very closely related to Effexor, and that is generic. So I think that your daughter should talk to the psychiatrist about going on Effexor potentially instead of Prestique. They're very closely related, and that may work just as well without being so expensive.
Okay.
The other thing is she interested in therapy, or is that not something she wants to do?
I can't imagine not having therapy if you're on an antidepressant, that you do need to have some type of therapy, mm-hmm. but it seems that it's not given as an option, or she may be just rejecting as an option. I don't know.
Well, ask her. You know, maybe if mom brings it up, she'd be willing to think about it. If this doctor is seeing her for 10 minutes, maybe it's just not coming up in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
think
about Effexor. That's the alternative.
Thanks, Nancy.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Let's go to Donna in Saratoga. Donna.
Hey, hi, how are you today?
So far, so good, but we're running out of time here, so go ahead.
Okay, my son is 34. He has schizophrenia. He had given up smoking, a couple of years ago probably, but with his injectable antipsychotic medication, he's eating not really the best foods. He's gaining weight, and yesterday he said he thinks he's going to start smoking again so he won't be gaining so much weight. Do you have some suggestions of what he can do so he won't start smoking?
Well, could he speak to a nutritionist? Oftentimes, if he's in treatment, there's a nutritionist connected to the program. And if they can help him with his diet, I always tell my patients, don't eat white food. You know, those are the carbs, and that tends to give us belly fat. If he could get some support, some help, maybe he would stop planning to go back to smoking and work on the eating plan instead.
Right. Yeah, I've suggested he have some carrots in his refrigerator and stuff like this, and he kind of looks at me like, I'm not so sure about that, but I think consulting a nutritionist might be a good idea. He does go to therapy, and he's got a good support system, so we'll just maybe see if we can add that one in.
Okay, thank you, Donna.
Okay,
now let's go to, and this is going to be it, Evie in Hyde Park. Evie, you're on.
Hi, I need help in a way to get my 19-year-old son into therapy. He left school in May, and very smart guy, but didn't seem to be engaged, didn't do well in school. He's actually living with my ex-husband, so I don't have a lot of access to him. He seems very angry at me, which really no reason for that at all, but he doesn't really go out of the house. He doesn't want to work. He doesn't want to talk about school. He seems very angry whenever I try to approach him, and I'm just wondering how I can get him help. I was able to get him to go through my ex-husband to one session, but that, about 3 months ago, but that was it. So any ideas about what I can do?
Sure. Sometimes it helps if you engage in therapy and invite him into your therapy rather than pushing him, let him know you need some help or you would like him to come and join you. So it's kind of a backdoor way of getting him in.
Right. He seems very reticent and angry at other members of the family. So it's hard to even talk to him. And, I'm reaching out to him through love and all positive reinforcement, but I'm just really frustrated because I'm worried about him and wondering what I can do.
Well, the only other thing is NAMI. Go to a NAMI meeting. They will help you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. I'm so sorry to Lynn and Shelburne. We're just not going to have time to take your call today. And I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels, our friend of the Breen Center, for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprasin, creams designed to heal muscle aches, back, neck, and shoulder pain, injuries, carpal tunnel, and more. Toprasin.com. Thanks to our engineer, the great Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall, and I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/VoxPop. On tomorrow's program, we'll be talking with a guy who is really interesting. He's done a little bit of entrepreneurship, which is very untypical. Stay tuned now for a news update.